Camelot v. Grant Thornton. Mr. Weiss first.
May it please the court. My name is Sanford Weiss first and I represent the appellant Dr. Bondi. The Second Circuit ordered mandatory abstention and remand in this case. Grant Thornton, the defendant, then waited several months until the case was retransferred to the Northern District of Illinois from the Southern District of New York before asking that court to retain jurisdiction and disregard the Second Circuit's mandate. That was error for several reasons. First, there are the anti-review provisions, 28 U.S.C. 1334D and 28 U.S.C. 1452B. These provisions say that
How would you suppose that the Peterson case had been a case of the case decided by the Supreme Court of Illinois, and suppose it had discussed not only what is discussed in our Peterson decision, but it discussed at length, you know, the adverse interest doctrine and audit interference and whether in pari delicto is a complete defense or a partial defense. In other words, discussed all of the issues that are germane in the Parmalat suit. Would your position be the same? Suppose all this had happened, Peterson had been issued after the Court of Appeals decision in New York, and moreover, forget about the rehearing, you know, that complication. So in that situation, would you think that Judge Darrow would still be obligated to remand the case to the Cook County Circuit Court?
Our argument under the anti-review provisions would still apply in that instance. And it's not a ridiculous notion because...
Why wouldn't it be ridiculous?
Because as soon as the case goes back to the Illinois State Court, that court is fully capable of taking into account the intervening Illinois Supreme Court decision in your hypothetical. We're not saying that this hypothetical Peterson as decided by the Illinois Supreme Court decision could not be considered in the case. What we're saying is that Congress's design...
But if the object of the remand to the Circuit Court of Illinois is to get an authoritative interpretation of Illinois law, if that has been made already by the Illinois Supreme Court, then what would be the point of the remand to the Circuit Court? What would be gained by that?
Congress, when it enacted these provisions, accompanied by the anti-review provisions, it was a policy that these cases, there's too many cases coming into federal court unrelated to bankruptcy jurisdiction. And Congress decided as a policy matter, it's better to have the state courts deciding these issues with state law.
That's true in general, but if the state court has already made its decision, then what is the point of another remand in which the court would just say, we've decided that. Yeah.
Well, there still would be an issue of how to apply those rules of law to the facts here. In the hypothetical Peterson decision, you had mutual funds and factors, different facts than here. Even if the rules were settled,
I don't think you want to refer to the Peterson decision. Peterson is the standing trustee in a lot of bankruptcy cases. This court has at least 100 Peterson decisions. You might want to refer to McGladrey and Pullen. We don't have more than one McGladrey and Pullen decision.
Peterson v. McGladrey and Pullen was what I was intending to refer to. But let me shift gears slightly and talk about, in the hypothetical, as compared to this case, Peterson did not resolve
McGladrey and Pullen, you mean.
Pardon me. Let me just say McGladrey for ease of reference. McGladrey did not resolve all of the Illinois issues in this case. And
I know. That's why I was giving you a hypothetical.
Sure. Right.
Issues that could be raised here were resolved in some, identical case.
Right. What I'm trying to suggest there is even if the rules of law were settled definitively by the Illinois Supreme Court, there still could be issues of applying those rules to the facts here, and that
but
is still...
But suppose they weren't.
I may have run out of answers on this line of hypothetical.
Why are you resisting the point, the proposition, that if there's no point whatsoever in having the case tried in a state court, then there's no point whatsoever? Your proposition is that there is some point.
Well, the only point that I can see that might remain with the application.
I think we need to move in a different direction. If we should have started this, I think, by asking about appellate jurisdiction. Does the judgment from which you have appealed resolve all claims involving all parties?
The judgment from which Dr. Bondi appeals, there's a 54B judgment that resolves the claims and confers appellate jurisdiction on this court as to Grant Thornton U.S. and Grant Thornton International. That is clear. It's not contested by either of the parties, and I know that doesn't bind the court, but the 54B judgment makes sense in this instance. I don't think.
Could you answer my question, please?
Yes, the 54B judgment confers jurisdiction.
Now, look, I asked a factual question. Does it resolve all claims against all parties?
No, it does not.
All right. No. Which claims against which parties have not been resolved?
Okay. There are claims against an entity called Grant Thornton SPA, which is sometimes referred to as Grant Thornton Italy in the briefs. There's a default judgment on liability, but there's no definitive decision.
No definitive ruling on damages.
That's right.
And you know that the Supreme Court held in Wetzel against Liberty Mutual that Rule 54B cannot be used to authorize an appeal when there is a ruling on liability but not damages. Now, I understand that you have thought you could resolve that problem by dismissing that claim with leave to reinstate after the appeal. Is that correct?
I think Your Honor may be mistaking Dr. Bondi for PCFL, our co-appellant. PCFL did abandon its claims against Grant Thornton Italy. Dr. Bondi, by contrast, has preserved his claims against Grant Thornton Italy.
Well, then I don't know how you can do it under Wetzel against Liberty Mutual.
Well, I think the distinction is that these are separate defendants, they're separate entities, and therefore the fact that there are still remaining issues as to one defendant does not prevent the 54B judgment as to two separate defendants, which, again, are Grant Thornton U.S. or Grant Thornton LLP and Grant Thornton International. As to those two defendants, there is a 54B judgment. We are not saying that we are up before this court at all on the Grant Thornton Italy issues. That is not before the court, and I think if we were to say that, we would have a problem with that Supreme Court decision. But as to Grant Thornton U.S. and Grant Thornton International, we think the 54B judgment provides appellate jurisdiction.
Let me ask you another question. There's discussion of delay in this litigation if the case goes back to the Circuit Court of Cook County. So I have two questions related to that. First, have any statistics been presented about delay in the Illinois court system of major commercial cases?
Yes. In the Second Circuit, following the first remand to Judge Kaplan, we supplemented the record per the Second Circuit's instructions and presented a declaration by a former Cook County judge named Judge Meacham. And what his statistics showed, and they were basically unrebutted, they're in the record, and I can provide the exact site on rebuttal, but what these statistics showed is that it's not appropriate to just look at the run of Illinois cases in general.
Right.
It's appropriate to look at a case that is sufficiently factually developed, as this case is, that would go immediately to summary judgment, and let's find out how long that would take as compared to federal court. And the upshot of that analysis was that it would be at most a few months, and that's what the Second Circuit actually found in its second decision, at most a few more months faster in federal court as opposed to state court. And not only was that delay minimal, but it was a delay that was not going to impact the U.S. bankruptcy case because it was a 304 case.
Okay,
and it was not
I do remember the reference to a few more months, but you say that was actually based on statistics of cases regarded as comparable.
Yes, Judge Kaplan had made a similar observation way back before the first appeal. But during the appeal, we presented detailed statistics on a case in this posture through this declaration, which was essentially unrebutted by the other side. And the Second Circuit, having reviewed that, found that, yes, indeed, in this case, it was going to be a very minimal extra delay in state court as opposed to federal court, and that that delay would not affect any of the bankruptcy interests that would justify denying mandatory abstention.
My question, which I think you argued somewhere, Is this litigation sufficiently separate from the bankruptcy litigation so that even if it took a long time, it wouldn't have an impact?
Yes, let me try to address that. So what we're dealing with here is an Italian bankruptcy estate. And that bankruptcy estate, the duration of it is not tied at all to the duration of this suit. To the contrary, it's tied only to an Italian Supreme Court appeal, which is actually still pending, but is to be resolved shortly, we believe. Even after that happens, however, in Italian law, unlike U.S. law, creditors can still be admitted and get recovery. There's no bar date in Italy as there is here. And we presented these statistics in this analysis to the Second Circuit, and it's crucial because any minimal delay that might result in state court has no impact on any bankruptcy interest. And that's what 1334 is about. It's about, do we need a quicker resolution in order to further a bankruptcy purpose? And the Second Circuit discussed that, resolved it, and Peterson v. McGladrey in Poland does not question at all that aspect of the Second Circuit's abstention analysis. If I could turn briefly to the Illinois law issues that McGladrey addresses.
Sure. Before you go there, if we order a remand to the state courts, what happens to your claims against Grant Thornton in Italy?
Grant Thornton in Italy?
Mm-hmm.
Those claims would go back down as well.
As part of this order,
as part of
under the 54B jurisdiction.
Let me actually just reconsider that slightly. It may be that we would have to brief that issue before the district court. I believe that
remand is usually kind of an all or not. Well, removal is all or nothing. Remand.
Right. The entire case was removed. Mm-hmm. What hasn't been briefed as this case comes to this court are what Illinois law issues are there as to GT Italy. However, the Second Circuit's mandate was indeed to send the whole case back. There is an issue of whether Grant Thornton Italy was up before the Second Circuit on the 54B. I believe it might be appropriate to have further briefing on that specific issue, but I think in the interest of judicial economy, we would certainly argue that Grant Thornton Italy should go down as part of the same case. What hasn't been briefed are the specific Illinois law issues that affect the damages determination as to Grant Thornton Italy. Briefly, if I could talk about the Illinois law issues that Peterson does not address. The first and foremost of those is the audit interference doctrine. And this court in Peterson, when we looked at the briefs in that
you
case.
You mean McGladrey and
Peterson v. McGladrey. I apologize. I'm very used to discussing it in different terms. In McGladrey, the briefs did not discuss audit interference. They did not discuss the Board of Trustees decision. And we have other sister state courts that on certifications from federal courts of appeals have recently discussed exactly that issue and split 2-1. It's a very complicated policy issue. It's one that Board of Trustees does not definitively resolve, but points in a certain direction. And it's one that the first Holland decision cited in our briefs does explicitly discuss. Now, granted, that was an intermediate appellate court decision, but we think that that issue, among others, remains for decision by the Illinois courts, and it is a very important issue that other states have been addressing recently, and that was really the linchpin of the Second Circuit's abstention decision. If I could reserve the remainder of my time, well, I guess I don't have any, but if I could request one minute,
you can, of course,
with permission.
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Weisberg. Mr. Taylor?
May I please the court? The summary judgment evidence in this case showed that Parmalat Capital Finance Limited, which we call PCF.
Mr. Taylor, maybe I need to ask you my question about appellate jurisdiction.
Okay.
What's the status of this default judgment? And are you appealing based on a Rule 54B order?
I'm not appealing based on a Rule 54B.
All right. So
order.
What's the status of this default judgment?
We don't have a default judgment against Grant Thornton Italy, and we have abandoned our claims directly against Grant Thornton Italy.
Abandoned? I mean, I had this understanding that it was abandoned with leave to reinstate after we were done with this appeal.
I tried to do that, but after three different questions
and as
from
you
this
know,
court,
that's forbidden.
After three different questions from this court, we simply abandoned them.
It has now been abandoned conclusively.
Correct.
All right. Thank you.
The summary judgment evidence said that PCFL was insolvent at all relevant times. So at the for every time that it matters in this case, the only stakeholders of PCFL were its creditors. The shareholder, Parmalat, was out of the money. There was never going to be enough money coming into PCFL for anyone at Parmalat or any employee or director of PCFL, for that matter, was ever going to get any money. The fact of insolvency itself is a key distinction, I believe, between this court's Senko case and the McGladrey case that we've been discussing. In those cases, the fraud that was occurring was not occurring while the company whose insiders were conducting the fraud was insolvent. They may have become insolvent later, but at the time of the fraud, no. In cases such as Schacht, McCrae, Holland, they all say that prolonging the life of an insolvent company while its assets are being dissipated is no benefit to the company. It's fraud what was used in Senko. It is fraud against the company.
Well, Parmalat certainly had a period in which it swelled mightily, became huge, and so forth. Doesn't that count as...
Well, first of all, I am drawing a distinction between PCFL and Parmalat.
You don't want to discuss Parmalat.
But Parmalat's swell, PCFL did not swell. Parmalat did. No question about it. But the thing with Parmalat swelling was it was still based on a fraud. Right. And at all relevant times, even while it was swelling, Parmalat probably also was insolvent. But I know for sure that PCFL was, because there's summary judgment evidence in the record that shows from 97 forward, they're insolvent every single year and the insolvency increases greatly. That's the Regan report. And while there has been some disagreement about what should happen with Bondi's expert reports, Regan was not challenged and was not stricken. There is no question that PCFL was insolvent at all relevant times. And that is what brings in Schacht. That's what brings in McGrath. That's what brings in Holland. It's a key distinction. I might disagree slightly with how Senko phrased the test as opposed to how some Illinois courts have phrased the test, but really it comes down to the same thing. If it's fraud for or fraud against, if you're running a fraud against the company, then you have a reason to keep quiet. And that's exactly what the wrongdoers at PCFL did. By the way, the whole insolvency thing becomes especially true when Tona and Del Sedato, the wrongdoing guys at PCFL, not only know that PCFL is insolvent, they also know that Parmalat is insolvent and can never pay back the money that PCFL was giving it. Those were the contested issues on summary judgment, and that's a very different case.
PCFL was wholly owned?
It was wholly owned. Actually, I'm not sure that it was wholly owned by Parmalat Finanziaria or whichever it was, but certainly among the various Parmalat groups, it was wholly owned.
There are no outside shareholders.
Right, no outside shareholders.
Okay, well, I've lost the thread now. What's the relevance of PCFL being insolvent?
It's that the Illinois courts have held, cases like Schacht, McCrae, and Holland, all say that prolonging the life of an insolvent company as its assets are being dissipated is no benefit to the company. And what that means is that the directors who are doing that are adversely interested. And once they're adversely interested, then what they know doesn't count for PCFL. And as a result, PCFL cannot be a wrongdoer.
Can't prolonging the life of an insolvent company benefit the company? Maybe you prolong its life long enough and someone comes along and buys it?
That's exactly what Schacht, McCrae, and Holland said was not the case. They said that by prolonging it and dissipating the assets, which is happening in PCFL, all you're doing is you're taking money away from the natural constituency of PCFL at that point, which is the creditors. It's the creditors that are harmed by the fraud. The creditors are the victims. And in the PCFL case, if PCFL recovers, it's the victims who recover. There is no chance, as there was in Senko, no chance that any of the wrongdoers will ever get a dime.
Under Illinois law, are creditors of the customer or client of an auditor able to sue directly for malpractice?
You know, I'm sure that there's cases that I would like to say go both ways, but as a general rule, no, they cannot. The claim belongs to the company. The company must make the claim against the auditor. In this case, the company effectively is like a bankruptcy estate, and whatever comes into PCFL is going to go out to the creditors, the people that were damaged in the case. That's why the case is so different from some of the other ones that have been brought forward. There is a question about even if there is adverse interest, which because of insolvency, I think there has to be. Even if there's adverse interest, does a sole actor exception apply? Because Parmalat is, Parmalat's the big Parmalat. They're the owner of the company. But remember, Parmalat's out of the money. So really, the relevant controller of PCFL should be its creditors. But even apart from that, the evidence here showed that at PCFL for all times, both while it was in the Cayman Islands and while it was in Malta, had innocent directors who did not know of the fraud. Okay, the fact that they didn't know of the fraud shows you that somebody's keeping it from them, which plays into adverse interest. But it also shows that there are people there who could have done something. They testified that they would have done something, and the evidence was when it came down to being disclosed publicly that there was a problem, they held a board meeting and stopped transfers from PCFL. That's the summary judgment record. I'm not a fan.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Taylor. Ms. Coberly?
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I represent GTUS. I'll be arguing for all defendants on the abstention issues and the imperi delicto ruling. Mr. Bernard will address GTI Limited and the lawsuit by PCFL, which doesn't involve my client. There's no question that this is an unusual case, but there's nothing particularly radical about what Judge Dara did. This Court has long held that a district court can and should take intervening authority into account on remand. That's true even if the Court of Appeals denied a petition for rehearing that raised the same intervening authority. And here, of course, we don't even have that case because the intervening authority arose just days before the petition for rehearing was denied. Section 1334D really has nothing to do with it. Congress was very specific about what's prohibited. Appellate review by the Court of Appeals and by the Supreme Court under certain statutes. Judge Dara didn't review the Second Circuit's ruling at all. To the contrary, he took it as a given. He enforced it. He looked at it as the law of the case.
In what sense did he enforce it?
Well, he started with that premise. And if you read his opinion,
the Second Circuit's mandate required him to send this case to state court. He didn't enforce the mandate.
He didn't enforce the mandate.
He decided that he knew better.
The mandate was simply to remand to Judge Kaplan to send it back to state court. The Second Circuit realized and said in its opinion that the Northern District of Illinois was the only court with authority to send the case back to Cook County. So Judge Dara had a decision to make. He started with the Second Circuit's decision.
Assume you think this is the law of the case rather than the mandate rule. In what way would a district court be entitled to depart from the law of the case under the principles of Christensen against Colt Industries Operating Corporation?
Well, one way is under Colt versus Christensen, it would be if the decision is clearly erroneous. But that's not what Judge Dara did here. What
district
he did was
didn't
apply
say
intervening
that.
Authority. It said if there's clear error, it said law of the case is not absolute. But all that happened here was that the district court took into account clear authority from this court that held that the unsettled issues that the Second Circuit was concerned about were not unsettled.
See,
That's nuts.
I don't think that's what the Peterson opinion holds.
What McGladrey and Pullen holds is that we are not going to depart from a decision we reached in 1982, Senko against Seidman and Seidman. And unless I very much misunderstand things, 1982 substantially preceded the Second Circuit's decision.
That's true, Your Honor. But what the Second Circuit looked at, it actually cited the Peterson District Court decision
for
the proposition.
You mean the McGladrey and Pullen case.
I apologize.
Do you realize not only what I said to your adversary, the McGladrey and Pullen case is one of at least 13 separate appeals in the Lancelot Fund cases. This court has issued multiple opinions in the Lancelot Fund cases, all of which are Peterson against somebody. Referring to a case as Peterson is like referring to a case involving the Commissioner of Internal Revenue as the Halvering decision. There are hundreds of them.
I understand, and I apologize, Your Honor. You must forgive me. We began briefing this issue in the Second Circuit in our 28J letter, and there it was clear which case we were talking about, and I apologize for the confusion. I'll try to correct myself.
You may realize, by the way, that in one of the other cases in Lancelot, which has not been discussed, I have to see if I can remember, was another in pare delicto case involving a professional.
I do recall
and
that.
And it came out the other way.
It did, for a very specific reason, and I will speak about that for a second.
In part because Illinois law has some ambiguities in it that one might think would benefit from a decision by an Illinois court.
I got derailed by the nomenclature issue. What this decision said was 30 years have passed and no court in Illinois has disagreed with this understanding. Now, does that mean that Illinois courts have actually followed Senko, or the issue just never arose?
The part of that decision that I'd like to focus on first, Your Honor, is where it says very clearly Illinois applies this doctrine to suits by clients against their auditors. So that's one.
It says a lot of different things.
It does. But that's one of the...
Including that in essence it's not for the federal courts to innovate, right, on public policy grounds. But that's entirely appropriate for the Illinois courts to consider, right?
It would be.
So why was the Second Circuit right to think that this case would be better handled in the Illinois courts?
What the Second Circuit said was very specific. It said that certain issues, basic questions regarding in pare delicto under Illinois law, are unsettled. And for that proposition, it cited the federal district court case in Peterson versus.
As
Illinois.
One example. It's
as
a
one
shortcut.
Example. As
it's
one
a e- shortcut.
That's right. As one example. Another example, it went on from that proposition, and we know, by the way, that the Peterson versus McGladrey decision did conclusively resolve that issue that the Second Circuit specifically cited. Then the Supreme
Court. For Illinois law for all time?
The federal court can't resolve an issue of state law. It can give its best guess, but it's always open to the Illinois Supreme Court to say no, we don't agree with Senko or this or that or the other thing.
It's certainly open to the state courts to do that, but that's not what the Second Circuit was concerned about. The Second Circuit discussed whether there were certain issues that were unsettled, not issues that could be innovated, not issues that new arguments that a plaintiff could make. The Second Circuit talked about issues being unsettled, and for that proposition it cited a Northern District of Illinois federal court case.
Yes, I know. That's a funny site. Is there any Illinois state decision of the Supreme Court of Illinois which answers these questions and makes clear what their position is?
The law of Illinois has been clear for some time, as this court said in Peterson versus McGladrey.
No.
Illinois.
What we said in McGladrey and Pullen was that the Illinois judiciary had not disagreed with Seidman and Seidman, but it had reserved, under some circumstances, the right to create exceptions to this defense based on public policy. We reiterated that in the Winston and Strawn appeal. Well, that certainly sounds like the issue is not utterly resolved in Illinois. I otherwise don't understand what these public policy exceptions are.
The part of the Peterson versus McGladrey decision that I'd like to refer the court to is not the part relying on Senko. It's on page 3 of the slip opinion, and it says, Illinois applies this doctrine.
Boy, that'll help us find it. Is there something wrong with citing Fed Third?
Illinois, I apologize. Illinois applies this doctrine to suits by clients against their auditors because a participant in a fraud cannot claim to be a victim of its own fraud, citing First National Bank of Sullivan, Holland, and Senko. So the first two citations following that are Illinois decisions. The other thing I'd like to point out is that the Second Circuit itself would not regard this court's decision as simply just another federal court's decision on state law. There's no question that this court doesn't...
But there are all sorts of hedges in the opinion. For example, this makes it unnecessary to consider limits that Illinois law places on investors' efforts to make direct claims against auditors. Or Illinois has limited the defense in pari delicto on public policy grounds in some circumstances a matter of its domestic law and lists several cases. Then it moves on and discusses federal bankruptcy law. So, I don't know, I think the case leaves open a lot. And
Your Honor, the cases that you're referring to that McGladrey cited as this public policy idea, they're the very ones that my colleague a moment ago was citing. McGrath is one of them. There's a particular doctrine that this court has recognized applies only to statutory insurance receivers who stand in the shoes of creditors as well as the company itself. That is why, and I'd like to turn, if I could, to this argument that you heard several times, Holland, McGrath, Schacht. Those decisions were, in particularly McGrath and Schacht, they were decisions involving a statutory insurance receiver who, by Illinois statute...
There are also Illinois appellate court cases. Are there Illinois Supreme Court cases that... establish these principles that you're arguing?
No, but the lack of an Illinois Supreme Court case does not make a case unsettled, a proposition unsettled. It simply means that the Illinois Supreme Court hasn't had the opportunity to say so. If this court wanted to give the Illinois Supreme Court the opportunity to say so, certification would be the appropriate route, not sending the case back to the state court to begin over.
I don't understand that at all, given the posture of this case. Let me ask you, I guess from a slightly different angle, Ms. Coverly, if we accept your argument, say this is just law of the case, the district judge is free to reconsider all this, I would think we'd be creating a circuit split with a greased path toward the grant of certiorari, where two federal circuits have disagreed on the issue of mandatory abstention in exactly the same case. Don't you think that would
which
occur?
Other if on we, the issue of mandatory abstention?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. It would not be a circuit split.
So far as I know, by the way, that's happened only once in American law. It was Christensen against Colt Industries, and we got our hat handed to us on a platter.
If I were looking at that petition for certiorari, Your Honor, it would be very clear it was not a circuit split because there is an intervening authority that the Second Circuit itself would regard as authoritative on matters of Illinois law.
And that's a very... It is not an intervening authority about the meaning of Section 1344.
Well, that's correct, but
we're not... If there was some intervening authority about when abstention is required, that would be interesting. But... A new case saying we are not changing the position we adopted in 1982 seems to me not an intervening authority.
To be clear, Your Honor, that is not the part of Peterson-McGladrey that we are relying on. We are relying on the part of Peterson-McGladrey that says Illinois applies this doctrine to suits by clients against their auditors and resolves the question whether a bankruptcy trustee or innocent successor is allowed to invoke the doctrine of impari delicto. Those questions, that latter question, was resolved by this court in a controlling way, and that very question was noted as unsettled by the Second Circuit. Now, Your Honor, we have never, since we've been back in Illinois here, we have never taken issue with the reasoning of the Second Circuit and how it approached mandatory abstention. And believe me, I would like to, because I would note that the issue of unsettled case law is relevant only to permissive abstention and not to mandatory abstention under the statute. So we submit that the Second Circuit was completely wrong in how it approached this issue. That, if this court considered it, would be a circuit split. What we have here is a situation where the very thing that the Second Circuit found determinative, which is unsettled case law, has been addressed by this court, which did not find it unsettled, and said, in fact, that Illinois applies this statute. And cited Illinois cases for that proposition.
Do you agree with Mr. Coberly that referring this to the Illinois courts would just increase by a few months the length of time it would take to resolve the issues?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And I would like to address that for a second. We did put on quite a bit of evidence about the respective timeliness. It was all put on in front of Judge Kaplan. I'd just like to correct something my colleague said. There was nothing new presented to the Second Circuit in this respect. Judge Kaplan looked at the different affidavits. You can find a discussion of that at pages 2 to 6 of our brief before Judge Kaplan. Judge Kaplan looked at that evidence and found that it would take the state courts a matter of years to reach the point where this case is now. And there's a couple reasons for that. First of all,
A matter of years. Of course, if the district court had done what the Second Circuit said, this case would have been in the Illinois courts for the last 2 years, and the case would now be over.
Your Honor,
with a matter of years to resolve.
I don't know that that's true, Your Honor. Because if this
one
case went back to...
One can never know about alternative states of the universe. But we do know that this case has dragged on for an extra 2 years because the district court did not follow the Second Circuit's decision.
Well,
the Second Circuit made its decision in February 2012, and we are here arguing in the Seventh Circuit at the end of May 2014.
I'd like to start with the first 7 months of that, which are squarely the responsibility of the appellants, who did not ask Judge Kaplan to move the case along until for 7 months, even though we asked immediately.
Do the parties have to ask a district court to follow a mandate from the Court of Appeals?
There was, in that court, the same...
What's the answer to that question?
The answer is no, sir.
Thank you.
If I could get back to Judge Posner's question, we presented evidence showing that the delay in state courts was significantly longer than in federal court. Judge Kaplan looked at that. The only evidence to the contrary that plaintiffs presented was this Meacham affidavit, which reported on a conversation retired Judge Meacham had with Chief Judge Pierce of that court. It was hearsay within hearsay. And Judge Kaplan found that it was, in fact, going to be a matter of years. Now, if I could turn to the Holland case, this issue, and this is related to the issues that the court, that my opponents were suggesting were unsettled, and they refer repeatedly to the Holland decision. The plaintiffs have consistently miscited the Holland decision and ignored its subsequent history. It is true that on a motion to dismiss, Holland concluded that the doctrine of impari delicto would not apply because there were sufficient allegations in that case of harm to the company and no benefit. Dr. Bondi and PCFL have ignored that the trustee lost on summary judgment. In that very same case, the case that is really the core of plaintiff's argument that law is unsettled, the Illinois Appellate Court held that by hiding the company's insolvency and allowing it to continue to borrow, the fraud harmed the creditors and not the company. That's why it's so critical to look at the cases, again, that the plaintiffs are relying on for the proposition that the law is unsettled, which Schacht and McRae, which specifically apply to a situation where the receiver is representing the creditors. Here, Dr. Bondi, for example, actually brought claims on behalf of the creditors at the beginning of this lawsuit. Those claims were dismissed, and that dismissal has never been appealed. Dr. Bondi has conceded for years that he stands in the shoes of the company itself, and that is all. I'd like to turn, if I could, just very quickly to the Caterpillar case. There's no dispute here that Judge Kaplan and the federal courts have proper jurisdiction over this case. If there was any error, it was a statutory error in application of 1334C2. And for those kinds of errors, where many years have passed and the case has reached an appealable judgment, the Supreme Court has instructed that considerations of finality and efficiency call for keeping the case in federal court.
So wouldn't that always be the case where a district judge has erroneously denied mandatory abstention and ruled on the merits?
I would not say that would always be the case. I think this court could decide based on the circumstances. In this case, it's been 10 years. The plaintiffs have said that the case has been languishing.
Ten years in the wrong courts, according to the Second Circuit.
10 years while the case was being actually litigated and moved forward by a court with proper jurisdiction. During that time, Judge Kaplan presided over discovery that reached the entire world. He decided countless motions. He ruled on issues that relate to the admissibility of expert testimony. He ruled on motions to dismiss. He ruled on other summary judgment issues. If we went back to state court at this point, the number of issues that would have to be decided even before the court got to impere delicto is kind of astonishing. We would first obviously be litigating the law of the case impact of the federal court's judgments and decisions. We would also need to relitigate issues of experts. Presumably, the plaintiffs would want to relitigate the summary judgment issues they lost. We, if they do that, we would have the ability to relitigate the summary judgment issues they won. There is a lot that would have had to happen, and for that reason, there would be delay. And that's why we think the only factor that tipped the judgment in favor of keeping the Second Circuit's judgment in terms of keeping this case in federal court was the unsettled nature of state law. The Second Circuit regards this court, as more authoritative than the Second Circuit on issues of Illinois law. We know that because it cited the Peterson decision, the Peterson versus McGladrey District Court decision, and we infer from that, and based on the Second Circuit's other cases, which we have cited in our briefs, that the Second Circuit would regard this court's statements about what Illinois law is today as being authoritative for purposes of the Second Circuit's consideration. Would it govern necessarily what the Illinois Supreme Court did? No. Should it govern what the Second Circuit's analysis was and whether this case should remain in federal court? Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Fogelman. Mr. Bernard?
May it please the Court, James Bernard on behalf of Grand Thornton International and Grand Thornton International LTD. I'd like to address the adverse interest issues that were raised by PCFL. There's no question that PCFL did what it set out to do, what its corporate purpose was. PCFL is a unique entity. It has no employees. It has no offices. It is a financing entity. Its purpose and the reason it existed was to raise money for the benefit of other Parmalat entities, and once that money was raised, to distribute that money to the Parmalat entities. Judge Posner, you asked the question, can prolonging the life of an insolvent company be an act for the company or for the benefit of the company? I think in this case, yes, it absolutely can, because the only thing that PCFL did as a finance entity was to raise money and then to distribute it. By prolonging the life of this company, regardless of when it became insolvent, PCFL was able to do the very thing that it set out to do, the very reason it was created. The adverse interest exception, therefore, does not apply here, because the manner in which its directors went about doing this, if we accept the evidence, which was to lie about the condition of Parmalat, to lie about its financial health, that was an act for the benefit of the company. That enabled PCFL to raise this money and to distribute it. Importantly, in this matter, in the way in which the case was briefed before the district court, there was an appeal in a related action involving Bank of America. Bank of America and the Grant Thornton entities jointly briefed the issues of impari delicto. As the court may be aware, the Second Circuit held that the mandatory abstention principles at issue in this case did not apply to Bank of America. And so when PCFL appealed all of the issues regarding impari delicto that have been raised here to the Second Circuit in the Bank of America matter, the Second Circuit summarily affirmed Judge Kaplan's decisions on all of these impari delicto issues, all of the evidentiary issues, all of the adverse interest issues, and everything else that had been raised in the district court. I therefore respectfully submit that in the event the court reaches these issues, there is no reason to depart from Judge Kaplan's reasoned decision that the adverse interest exception does not apply here and that the fraud that the directors of PCFL engaged in was for the benefit of and for the company. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Weisburs or Mr. Taylor?
I'd like to just pick up with something Mr. Bernard said. The Bank of America case is a bank, not an auditor, and audit interference is the principal state unsettled state law ground that the Second Circuit relied on. It did not cite McGladrey District Court. It cited it only as an EG. If the court could refer at its convenience to SA 141, second line, the Second Circuit is specifically citing the audit interference sections of the district court's decision. I'd also like to point out that in Peterson v. McGladrey and Pullen, even if this court did intend for all time to resolve certain issues of audit interference, and we don't believe it did, it addressed them only in the context of a negligent auditor. And here there are detailed allegations that Grant Thornton was in on the scheme and actually helped create sham entities to hide uncollectible receivables. This is far from a negligent auditor. It's a knowing auditor of the type that was addressed by the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania in the Ahrefs case, which is cited in our briefs. Finally, in the Holland case, which is referred to by Ms. Coberly, the summary judgment decision really is besides the point, and if anything, only raises further unsettled issues. One, it's not the principal case we rely on for audit interference. That would be Board of Trustees, an Illinois Supreme Court decision, which we think strongly supports our view. And secondly, in terms of the summary judgment stage of Holland, the plaintiff had offered three pieces of evidence specifically about damages to individual creditors. That is far from what is being offered here, and that is why the case was decided against the trustee on summary judgment there. Finally, the Caterpillar argument was raised and rejected by the Second Circuit, and like many other issues here, should not be revisited. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Coberly. And you have anything further, Mr. Bernard? You can have a minute if you want.
Two things. Just to pick up on the Board of Trustee point on audit interference that was just raised. In that case, the Illinois Supreme Court was forced to weigh some of the same things that they would have to weigh in this particular case. That is, should we encourage auditors to do their job, or should we encourage management to hire honest people? And back in the Cinco days, the choice here was, it's better to encourage management. But Board of Trustees seems to say that the Illinois courts are now coming down in favor of making auditors do their jobs. And the reason that they say that is because not only does it provide an incentive for the auditors to get it right, but it also provides an incentive for management not to get caught with something wrong. We haven't really touched on the GTIL very much, Grant Thornton International Limited. That case was dismissed at a pleading level. It involves one of the defendants that was issued here. It was dismissed at the pleading level. The pleadings were that Grant Thornton International had been stripped of its assets during this litigation. Fraudulent transfers, mere continuation, alter ego, all pleaded. That's enough to pass any plausibility test based on the summary judgment record. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much to all for our counsel. And